Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fraggle Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda.
Why does it seem abnormal or part of some liberal progressive agenda to do what's right for people, you know, and for the economy long term, you know, and for nature? Why is that weird? Why is that strange? Because it hasn't been normalized, because there are no positive social incentives except among a very small percentage of people around the world to have those kinds of conversations. And I liken this one to the changes in our social norms, for example, around same-sex marriage in many countries over the last just 20 years. There's no reason why we can't not just envision, but facilitate the same kind of societal evolution that has taken place around women's suffrage, around civil rights, around human rights, around slavery, around same-sex marriage. Why can't we do the same thing in one generation around nature and around climate change?
I'm very pleased today to welcome Brett Jenks to the podcast. Brett is the president and CEO of RARE, a global conservation organization whose mission is to inspire change so people and nature thrive. It's a global leader in using behavior change to achieve long-lasting conservation results. For over 40 years, RARE has empowered local leaders to inspire community pride and sustainable natural resource management so that both people and nature thrive. So thank you very much, Brett, for joining me today on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm really looking forward to talking to you about the work that you do at RARE and to understand the latest thinking, really, and research about the impact of individual behavior on climate change. And I know you have done some recent research looking at the drawdown listings, priorities, and identified some important priorities, I guess, when it comes to individual behavior. I'm just wondering first, maybe if you can just tell me a little bit about RARE and what you do.
Yeah, happy to. So RARE is a global conservation organization. We've worked in about 50 countries over the last 20 years. And in each of those countries, we have trained local leaders and mentored them and equipped them with the tools needed to influence the behavior of people living in and around marine protected areas, cloud forests, rainforests. Essentially, our mission is to inspire change so people and nature thrive. And what we've become pretty adept at is identifying the local leaders who can help influence the behavior of farmers and fishers so that they can potentially get greater yields while protecting the natural resource base on which they depend. And over the course of those 20 years, we've learned a good bit about behavior change, about the nature of human decision making and how conservationists can be more effective with their influence strategies.
That's really interesting, Brett. And I'd like to talk just maybe a little bit about behavior change. The scale of the problem, and I guess the time frame we're looking at, is terrifying. And daily in the newspapers, we see research about the scale of the problem and how again and again and again, things are getting worse much faster than people predicted, much faster than computer models. And now the various ways in which we can respond to these crises, particularly when it comes to climate change, and different parties, different stakeholders, I guess, have a different role. When it comes to my individual behavior, it can sometimes just seem overwhelming. You know, my children are very aware and watch my recycling behavior and my plastic bag consumption and so forth. And yet you read, you know, that China's opening, you know, tens of airports, they're doubling and tripling air traffic and economic growth is continuing apace. It just seems like a huge machine that's just going faster and faster. You know, what is the potential for individual behavior change and indeed for individual behavior change to spread to become group behavior change?
It does seem daunting to read the newspaper each day. The narrative that I think we experience in the United States right now is one of hopelessness. You mentioned the newspapers, the headlines, you know, your sense of impending doom. And I think that's natural. I think that's what most people are experiencing today. In fact, that somebody told me the American Psychiatric Association has recently come out with something that stated a certain percentage of youth today attribute their depression and anxiety to fears of climate change. So this is becoming, you know, literally an existential question, an emotional question. I think what we need is a new narrative. The challenge is that hopelessness curtails action. If we want people to take action, they need at least a modicum of hope. So we recently looked at the drawdown research. We looked at the drawdown list of the 100 things we can do to address global greenhouse gas emissions. And we asked ourselves, so which of those could we, the people, we as individuals, begin to move the needle on? And this is important because often people need to act their way into new beliefs. If you've ever tried to convince someone who vehemently disagrees with you by arguing with them logically or providing facts or even citations from peer-reviewed journal research, you further entrench their view. You make it tribal. You remove facts and logic and reason from the debate, and it becomes more like a feudal tribal war engagement. We need a new narrative that says we can do something. And so the good news is, there of the 100 drawdown insights, there are about 30 behaviors, some that would be appropriate for you or I, some that would be more appropriately applied by, let's say, a farmer in the developing tropics. But there's about 30 actions that we can take that if a significant percentage of people around the world took them, we could address fully one third of global greenhouse gases, which runs counter to the narrative that says, well, unless there's an act of Congress or some amazing new technology from Silicon Valley, there's nothing I can do. And that's just not true. So what we're hoping is to not just convince people, but to show people, to demonstrate people, to build a sense of momentum that people are able to take action that actually makes a difference. That's going to make them much more likely to vote, to encourage the kinds of policy changes down the road that we know inevitably are needed. But it gets the ball rolling. We have to begin to concern ourselves with this growing hopelessness.
So I'm interested in talking about what are the four or five most important or impactful things we can do. Just to be clear, is this really a kind of all things being equal? So we're not talking about political lobbying, new laws and things like that. We're just saying these are things that individuals can do today under normal circumstances.
There's no question that it's important for people to vote. It's important for people to let their representatives in Congress or Parliament or in their government understand that they care, they're interested, they're worried, and they want to see political action. Policy matters. Technology also matters. What's important about individual behavior change, though, is that it also matters and it's within your control day to day. You know, we only have elections every couple of years in the United States. It's not like we're going to flip Congress and get a carbon tax, you know, in the next 18 months. So what can people do until then? There's a lot that we can do as individuals. And so I'd be happy to go through some of those.
Yes, avenues. No, I'm definitely interested in talking about that. I mean, I guess you were talking about this polarization, and it is very polarized, particularly in America. But really, we've known for some time that certain behaviors, at least, are not good for the planet. How well have we done in actually, you know, responding to that and actually changing our behavior? Because, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about drawdown is it introduces a whole range and very powerful things that we can do that aren't so well known. But there are a core of things that we do know that we can do. How have we been doing that? And what's been stopping individual behavior? Because we know if we drive less or if we, you know, fly less, that is very impactful.
So RARE specializes in behavior change, as I mentioned. And over the last year, we've put together a network of some of the leading behavioral scientists in the world, partnering with the Stanford Design School to bring in design thinking, to be more empathetic, to think more clearly about where we find people today. You know, the average person asking themselves the same question you're asking, how do we influence their decision making about how to spend their time and their energy, what to do about climate change? And what we found is the traditional approach to influencing behavior is broken. You can't just tell someone they're wrong. You can't provide them facts and information. You can't send them a peer-reviewed journal article that says, here's scientific validation that I'm right and you're wrong. People just get further entrenched in their beliefs. I think this is something we see thanks to social media these days, where you know, you end up walking away from friends who simply won't agree with you politically, and the divisiveness grows. What speaks to people, what influences people, can be sort of, well, let me just explain to you how we've thought about this. We started reading everything we could find, from literally neuroscience, behavioral economics, social psychology, evolutionary biology. We looked around to scientists who had started to catalog all of the insights from all of this research the last 25 years. And really, you know, there are a couple hundred really interesting insights. The question is, how do you then bring them into a practice to become more effective in influencing the behavior, whether you're trying to convince your spouse to compost, you know, or your children to walk to school, or your organization to take less flights, you know, to meetings. How do we make that kind of change now that we know that these kinds of behaviors actually matter? And so we identified three big categories that are underutilized. One is emotional appeals. Mostly environmentalists have tried to invoke fear to instill a sense of panic, if you will. And that has built a constituency for conservation. There's a lot, millions and millions of dues-paying members of environmental organizations who worry about the plight of endangered species, who worry about the elephants and the rhinos and the tigers and the lions and the polar bears. And it's built a constituency, but it hasn't necessarily changed the behavior of the people who are the greatest threat to those species, number one. So what is emotionally appealing about nature or about taking new climate action that we can tap into? So I'll come back to this, but that's one category, emotional appeals. And we believe what's missing is a positive emotion about taking action. The second big category, if you will, is social incentives. And this is probably the most important one. We are inherently illogical animals. We like to think of ourselves, and economists would have us believe, that we are so rational that we make every decision with a kind of perfect calculus based on the opportunities and the costs, or the investment and the return. And yet, that's just not true. We do so many things that are illogical every day as human beings. We buy clothes that are trendy and expensive, but have no greater quality other than how it might influence our reputation with a very small circle of people around us. We might buy the same material with a different brand on it. How illogical is that? And yet we take that for granted. That's just fashion. That's just style. But we don't think about how social forces are influencing those kinds of decisions. Marketers do. Some marketers have gotten very good at this. But how do we use some of those same insights and those same skills to leverage social incentives so that it's normal to talk about what you're eating and where it comes from over dinner, so that it's normal to consciously be searching for ways to reduce your carbon footprint, so that it's a normal behavior to talk about the practices you use at work or at home with the choices you make around food or food waste, the kinds of products that you purchase, the kinds of questions you ask the people who are making your products. Why does it seem abnormal or sort of some part of some liberal progressive agenda to do what's right for people, you know, and for the economy long term, you know, and for nature. Why is that weird? Why is that strange? Because it hasn't been normalized, because there are no positive social incentives except among, you know, a very small percentage of people around the world to have those kinds of conversations. And I liken this one to the changes in our social norms, for example, around same-sex marriage in many countries over the last just 20 years. You know, how has same-sex marriage become normal to a significant percentage of people who several generations ago would have seen that as entirely abnormal? There's no reason why we can't not just envision, but facilitate the same kind of societal evolution that has taken place around women's suffrage, around civil rights, around human rights, around slavery, around same-sex marriage. Why can't we do the same thing in one generation around nature and around climate change? And so social incentives matter significantly. And the final one is really the simplest. There's so many different examples, but in some ways it's the newest. We call it choice architecture, but it's really how do you make things really easy for people to do? And, you know, one example from Europe is in the United States, we let people make decisions about whether or not they're going to donate their organs in the case of some calamitous accident, which leaves them not needing some organs anymore. You have to opt in. In many European countries, you actually are signed up when you get your driver's license to, and you have to opt out. You have to decide and check a box to say, no, actually, I don't want to share my organs with anyone who might need them after I no longer need them, which means you get upwards of 90% of people just opting in to organ donation programs. Whereas in countries that have the default being opt out, you get 10 or 15 or 20%. And so just by making the right decision really easy to make, we can influence behavior. So in summary, sorry that that's so long-winded, but I think it's really important to recognize emotional appeals, social incentives, and choice architecture are three wholly underutilized toolkits that will make a difference over the next 10, 15, 20 years in shifting climate-smart behaviors.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Now, the Drawdown 100, how did you go about doing this? And can we talk then about some of the key insights?
Yeah, it was really a simple question. I remember I took the Drawdown book home one weekend and skimmed through it and ended up just talking about it with everybody I knew over the course of a couple of days. Monday morning, I asked my team here at Rare, so how many of these behaviors, these let's call them behaviors, because they're behaviors like considering rooftop solar or eating a plant-rich diet. You know, you don't have to stop eating all meat, but the more veggies you eat and legumes and the less animal protein, the better it is for the planet and for climate change. Composting, food waste. For farmers in certain parts of the world, silvopasture, you know, planting trees in the middle of pastures, or no-till agriculture, regenerative agriculture. You know, there's 30 on a list like that that an individual consumer, an individual farmer could pretty easily adopt. And so then the question was, well, how significant are those? Because the most common narrative is it's all about clean tech. We need new batteries. We need wind and solar, maybe nuclear. And without those, we're never going to address the problem. The reality, though, is when you really look at the numbers, those things matter significantly. There's no question. We need to change the composition of our energy sources globally. We need to get rid of coal. We need to transition to wind, to solar, to renewable energy, period. But that only addresses maybe 30, 40, percent of the problem. There is a huge problem that comes right out of every household and every workplace and our dinner tables, and it's what we eat, how we eat it, it's how we travel, it's how we transport our goods, it's how we bring energy into our homes. And so it turns out 30 of those 100 behaviors that are in our daily control amount to somewhere between 20 and 36% of global greenhouse gases, meaning there are 30 behaviors we could adopt over the course of a year that would address one third of global greenhouse gases without an act of Congress, without a fancy new technology. So why aren't we making it personal? Why aren't we making climate change personal? There's so much we, the people, as individuals can do while we're asking. In fact, it makes then our appeal to our politicians even more credible because we've already done our part.
Absolutely, absolutely. Can you identify maybe three or four solutions that you found are the most impactful for individual behavior?
I would say the two at the top of the list are adopting a plant-rich diet and reducing food waste. Those two together, I'd have to get back to you with the exact percentage, but I think just adopting a plant-rich diet and dramatically reducing food waste yourself, of the food that you eat, adopted en masse, that could represent potentially 15, maybe 20% of global greenhouse gases.
Right. Now, when you say en masse, what kind of assumptions do you make here? I mean, what are we talking about? 20% of a nation, 30%, 100%? What kind of figures are you talking about?
Unfortunately, that's part two of the study, and we're about a week away. So I can't answer that. But it means a significant percentage of the population. So big round figure, I would guess, if we can get to 1 billion people, we're well on our way.
Absolutely. Now, clearly, the situation, particularly when it comes to food, you mentioned that, is very different in the developed world from the poorer parts of the world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think many people who think about diet understand this. There's a great adage: if you want to live like a wealthy person for a very long time, you want to eat like a poor person in the developing tropics. Meaning, you want to eat a lot of vegetables. You want to get a lot of your protein from legumes, from beans. Beans and vegetables with a little bit of carbohydrates, let's say from rice, is a very, very healthy diet. And as people in the developing world move into the middle class, they tend to want to emulate the diets of those in wealthier nations, more meat, especially more red meat. And that comes with a great cost to the environment. It also comes with great health risks. One of the greatest risks to adults in the United States, one of the greatest health risks for coronary and heart disease is our meat-rich diet. And so shifting a diet isn't just for climate change, it's also a good way of improving your own prospects for health.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, what do you know about the pace of change? Clearly, we've seen when it comes to the internet, I guess, and social media and many kinds of social phenomenon, pace of change can be breathtakingly fast. Things come in vogue and change quickly. When it comes to these kind of behaviors we're talking about here, when it comes to food, when it comes to, I guess, awareness and behavioral change, what do you know about how change happens and the pace of which change happens?
Yeah, one of the things that drives our work at RARE for a long time is the theory of diffusion of innovation. This is based on the work of a guy named Everett Rogers, a researcher from literally 30, 40 years ago, who was the first to look at the way that new strategies, new techniques for farming spread farm to farm across the country. And what he identified is the pattern that many use to describe Silicon Valley adoption of new innovation today. So it's interesting. It really hasn't changed. usually there's 1% of the population that you might call the innovators. People usually mention the early adopters, but actually that's the second stage of adoption. The innovators are the people who, you know, order the phone while it's being designed because they're so excited about the company or a new technology, and they're just always at the bleeding edge in a particular sector or segment. And so those innovators, that 1%, are the vegans, I would say, today when it comes to a plant-rich diet. They're the people who ordered the Teslas online 3 years before they were available. Those are the innovators. The innovators are usually the ones that are able to then provide testimonials to the early adopters, who are often much more influential. The early adopters are the one who hear about it first, who tend to write about these things, or who are very vocal about their, you know, their latest purchase, the newest gadget, the newest trend. And that's only about 2-4% of a population, the early adopters. Those are really the trendsetters, though. And so those, they matter. What's interesting is there's a new body of research now that would say that whereas in the past, what you wanted was to very quickly get to, you know, from the early adopters to get them to spread the gospel to the masses. And the reality is campaigns are far more effective if they leverage really tight bonds between those early adopters, you know, that next 2.5%, let's say, and then the next segment, which we would call the early majority. And so from the innovators to the early adopters, then finally, what matters most is to the early majority, which is maybe 12-15% of a population. So once you have the innovators, the early adopters, and you're beginning to get to most of the early majority, you're getting to what has been described as the tipping point. You know, when Malcolm Gladwell wrote The Tipping Point, most of the good ideas came from the 70 years of academic work and life of Everett Rogers. The tipping point comes when you are really getting to the point of having the first 15-20% of a population adopting new behaviors. So if you think about climate change, we're now at a point in the United States where 60 or 65% of Americans believe that not only does climate change exist, it's taken a while to get there, by the way, but that it's man-made. The question becomes, what percentage of Americans now believe that changing their diets, reducing food waste, putting rooftop solar on their homes, figuring out how to finance them, changing the way they get to work, thinking more purposefully about where the products they buy come from, you know, and so on and so on, yet signing up for renewable energy credits, even if they're not going to put panels on their roof, they can agree to essentially have a better source of energy. There's a whole host of things they can do. Where are we, is the next question, in the adoption of those behaviors? And that's the work that we are about to begin. And we've got to be quick about it.
Yes, absolutely. Interesting way you presented there in terms of the diffusion, as you say. And coming back to the food point and a plant-based diet, clearly that must be a major hurdle in America. I don't know what the figures are, something like 100 kilos of red meat and poultry or something eaten in the United States every year, just massively embedded in food culture and in the U.S. generally.
Yeah, this is the way many Americans self-identify. In the 50s, when modern technological industrial America was really established as a kind of culture, you know, it was there was a role for a male outside of the home. There was a stated role for a spouse inside the home. There were three square meals a day, and most of them had meat in them. I think about my great uncle, whose favorite breakfast on Sunday was double fried chicken, steak, gravy, biscuits, couple of fried eggs, and sausage. You know, you just shudder to think about. He, of course, eventually died of heart disease. But that sort of emphasis on meat being a measure of wealth has been and continues to be part of the culture for some Americans. And increasingly, it is an aspirational value for many people in the developing world. So how do you change that social norm? You know, what's interesting, I just saw last week, Jay-Z and Beyonce wrote the foreword to a new cookbook that's all about vegetarianism and veganism. You see celebrity chefs now trying to transition the composition of the American dinner plate so that instead of having a vegetable, the vegetables be the garnish, the protein, the meat, you know, the fish or the steak or the chicken should actually take up less than a third of the plate. It should be kind of a garnish for the vegetables and for the legumes. So the trendsetters, you know, that the innovators moving towards the early majority, I would say, are on the right path. The question is, how do we accelerate that change? Not because we need a sort of I feel no qualms about working to shift the diet of others, because it is in everyone's best interest, both from a dietary standpoint and from a natural resource standpoint, from the longevity of our species, that we evolve the way we inhabit the planet in order to make sure it continues to support us over time. We have co-evolved. There's no reason we can't, prompt or steer a little bit of our own evolution, especially around the way we live, given that we're already doing it genetically, we're already doing it scientifically and technologically. I think socially, we need to change our lifestyles faster than our climate is changing, or we're no longer going to be in control.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, just one other question at an individual level. The message is that as an individual, there is a lot we can do. You've identified these drawdown solutions, as you say, that are very impactful. What about actually also communicating and sharing the message? What are our few insights, our lessons for people? You warned us about spouting statistics at people about the benefits of different kinds of things. How can we be catalysts of individual behavior change?
I think one of the insights from the technology world, it's vivid in my memory, was sort of the first few times at an airport or out on the street that I saw someone talking on a cell phone, because that behavior was so visible, at first startling. You know, it seemed like a very public. Speaking on the phone used to be such a private matter. You know, you'd have a room for the telephone and there'd be a booth and it'd be very private. And now people walk around with headphones just spouting their daily business or their personal stories. That was a big transition, but because it was so visible, it caught on and spread very quickly. And so the question is, how do we make visible, how do we make seemingly so normal a number of these new behaviors? And I think social media offers us a huge opportunity for normalizing climate smart behaviors. So what I would look for over the next few years is just the number of stories and sharing. You know, is there a way for us to get social credit among our friends for the good work that we document? What I'd be looking for in the coming years is a way for climate smart behavior to offer a kind of social status. You know, if I were designing a campaign, it would be to figure out how people get paid socially and emotionally for being on the right team, for doing the right things. That's how we're going to normalize these behaviors. So social media in some ways can be very polarizing, but it can also create new social norms and new identities. And clearly, Homo sapiens need a new one as stewards of our atmosphere if we're going to make it through this next phase of our evolution.
What about government? Do you really believe this kind of individual social change, behavioral change, can take place without huge government support?
I think policy change is critical. I don't see it as either or. I think it's almost mutually reinforcing. I think often you have to get people, you know, why do people march in the streets? Why do organizers want people marching in the streets? It's for a couple of reasons. One, it's to show politicians that there's a movement, that there are voters, that they are mobilized, that they will take action. It is also to help people identify as being part of the solution, as being part of the movement, so that they'll vote in a way that aligns with the actions they've already taken. And I think people don't realize that that's also what's going on when you see public manifestations. So voting matters. Policy, at the end of the day, is what codifies social change. You can't get most policies in place unless you're living in a dictatorship without having a constituency behind those changes. You know, we live in a democracy. I still hope we do in the United States. And so often politicians, I like to say, don't usually lead. Politicians read the polls very carefully. They know what they can get away with. Politicians mostly follow where 60, 65% of the population is. So I think it's incumbent upon us, if we want change, to help move the population as part of the process of moving politicians. And this gets lost on many proponents of advocacy work, especially those who live here in Washington, D.C., who think, well, if I can convince the politician, you know, we probably can get the policy passed. Well, there's a lot of climate legislation that never got passed because the politicians got out ahead of their constituents.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of obstacles. I mean, you talked about the mobile phone. I guess that was a very good example of what for people, they got an advantage right away and it opened up a whole, you know, communications media world for them. When it comes to, let's say, taking some of these changes, there's a cost associated with it, however you measure those. And I'm just wondering if you talk a little bit about the status quo. If you take, for example, agriculture, you know, big agriculture, powerful politically and financially and has an impact. And clearly the fossil fuel industry as well with the subsidies and so forth. I don't know to what extent you have any reflections on vested interests.
I think, look, vested interests have been there. They will always be there. Hopefully there'll be a new array of vested interests. I think increasingly there is a new message to offer the incumbents, and that is that there is a lot of money to be made in new technologies that recognize our new climate reality. So as I go shop for food in my local market, and I see that there's now an entire row out of the 10 in my local supermarket, one entire row is dedicated to, I would just say, vegetarian, vegan, alternative diets. Many of the other, even in the fish or beef, you know, poultry sections now, a third to a half of the products have some labeling that or some certification that shows an intention that is increasingly aligned with our new climate reality. So from the food we eat to the energy that we consume, there are hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, moving towards $1 trillion in investment in wind and solar and alternative energy. Those were not mainstream investable propositions 20 years ago. Today, I wouldn't even call those impact investments. That is mainstream investing. Those are mainstream energy producers today. You have Tesla outselling BMW and Audi and Porsche in the United States, something unthinkable, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. So whether it's transportation, energy, the way homes are being built, the way buildings are being certified, or the food that we're buying, I think there's a revolution about to come in clothing. You know, the material that we buy, that we wear, we tend to give ourselves a pass on. But the millennials are being raised in an information-rich environment where value and meaning is as much a part of a brand or as is, you know, what would traditionally be called its fashion. And so the world's changing and industry will follow because they're going to want to be providing the products and services that the market wants. If we can shift our social norms you know, the economy will follow. So there is a real opportunity there as well to change the marketplace because it's fluid. It's changing.
Yes, yes. Just one last question connected to that. The quality of information we have about our lifestyles, the impact of buying particular products and so forth, our carbon footprint of different products and so forth, labeling and that kind of thing, very important. How have you factored that in? Have you looked at that? What needs to happen here? I mean, clearly it comes from regulatory is important, but also I guess you're suggesting that that organizations or corporations will respond as well to help clarify what kind of choices are available and the impact of different choices.
It's really important. I mean, knowledge is power, no question. And putting more knowledge in the consumer's hand makes the a knowledgeable consumer more powerful. And companies know this. You know, we've done a lot of work in fisheries over the last 7 or 8 years, and especially fisheries in the developing tropics. If you look at fisheries globally, less than 10% of fisheries are certified, have real, valuable, reliable, verifiable information about where the fish comes from, how it was handled, under what conditions it was caught or cultivated. And that's only about 10%. And yet, you know, people care where their food comes from. There are real challenges to getting that the information. At one point, the challenge was that people didn't care. Today, people care. At one point, companies didn't necessarily care because they weren't worried so much about scarcity. Today, every major corporation that's selling fish and moving it around the world is somewhat concerned about the reliability of their supply because of climate change, because of overfishing. And so there are a variety of new technologies from apps to traceability tracking to new experiments with blockchain that are enabling the provision of reliable data so that not just the consumer, but the company handling and shipping a fish to a market can have a real understanding of where the fish is, the and essentially, bottom line, its sustainability. So the question is, can we do the same thing for cotton, for rice, for corn, for wheat, for legumes, for soybean? And increasingly, that's happening. With the proliferation of information technology, it's getting so much easier to be able to trace what you're eating all the way back to the farmer that grew it or picked it or caught it. And that is a revolution in the making. Then the question is, so what's the dashboard that we carry around with us each day? You know, part of me thinks, God, it's such a shame that we have to do a carbon accounting every single day, you know. But what I imagine is paying my monthly credit card bill or looking at my monthly bank statement. It wouldn't be very hard to create an algorithm that would let me see on a monthly basis essentially what my carbon footprint is. You know, the algorithm could collect the data, run the numbers itself, and then print out, you know, here's the gross tonnage of carbon that you've emitted, and click here. And you can offset all of the emissions that you haven't been able to avoid yet with the changes in your own behavior and lifestyle. But if you want to do more than just be carbon neutral, if you want to actually move towards drawdown, you know, maybe you offset 30% more than neutrality would require. And I think we're going to get to the point where whether it's a carbon tax or whether it's a sort of app and social incentives or some economic incentives, the future is going to look like us knowing a lot more about our carbon footprint on a daily basis based on the dollars we spend so that we can be much more capable of managing our own footprint. That's where we have to end up.
Yes, a great idea, the drawdown app that at the end of the month takes all our spending and converts it into the implications and how we, you know, need to change our behavior to reach drawdown in these, particularly in these particular areas. Now, looking to the future, what's on the agenda? You talked a little bit about some research coming up. And I understand also there's a conference. So can you talk a little bit about what's on your mind, what your priorities are going forward?
Yeah, we have three big goals for behavior change in the conservation and climate change space. One is to build much greater demand for among practitioners and leaders to use these insights. One is to provide an evidence base to spur much more research, to demonstrate to the scientists that within our field that there really is proof that these things work. And then finally is to build capacity. We want to help train a network of thousands of conservation leaders and climate advocates to be more effective in influencing behavior, to be more effective in leveraging emotional appeals and social incentives, and choice architecture to move the masses so that we can all live more sustainably. So towards that end, we're coming out in the spring with a kind of manifesto, Rare's writing with the behavioral insights team that was created at 10 Downing after David Cameron and team read Nudge, that influential book 10 years ago by Cass Sunstein and the Nobel Prize winner, Richard Thaler. We're going to write an introductory guide to behavioral insights and nature conservation. We're holding on March 19th at National Geographic in partnership with the United Nations Development Program, National Geographic, the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, World Wildlife Fund. We're hosting what we call Beehive, which is sort of a behavior and environment hive, several hundred people comparing notes and building collective visions for how to tackle with hundreds of other organizations the kinds of behavior changes that are needed around food waste, adopting plant-rich diets, getting to work in a more sustainable ways. And then over time, our hope is that this becomes a new field, the field of applying behavioral insights and design thinking to nature conservation and climate change.
Fantastic. That's great. Menu of work ahead. And I wish you the very best of success with that, Brett. And thank you so much for joining me today and providing all these rich insights into how we can all make a greater contribution and deal with these our climate, our carbon emissions, and also help communicate about this. So I wish you the best, and thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.